right. Professor Fred, welcome back, man.
Hey, thank you, Teen. It's great to be here. It's been too long.
Yeah, last time you were on in the summer, I think we talked about Burnout Society, right?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And today our plan is to talk PMC, Professional Managerial Class.
Professional Managerial Class, yes. Are you part of the PMC? You are, right?
You think? I would admit to being in that class. I mean, yeah. If it is a class.
I guess we'll have to talk about that. But
yeah, I know. In some of the prep coming up to this discussion, you floated the idea that it's more like a culture or a psychology, and I think that's an interesting. It's an interesting question. You know, would it be better to actually call this thing, this group of people, professional managerial culture? I mean, that's one thought I've got.
Yeah. I mean, we're not starting from scratch, right? We've got a book that you mentioned to me before. I've heard mentioned many times. People have recommended it to me, as well as just the author, Catherine Liu. And the book is called Virtue Hoarders.
Yep.
There's a subtitle too to that, right? Virtue Hoarders.
The case against the professional managerial class.
The case against right. Which it is. It's a case against them, I would say. And Catherine Liu, who I believe is a professor of, is it sociology or is it media political studies, science?
Media studies.
Oh, media studies.
But it's definitely in the vein of sociology.
She's in the social sciences world anyway.
That's right. And she's at University of California, Irvine.
UC Irvine. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know what to make of that, actually. I don't know if that means anything to you about like the academic environment over at UC Irvine, but she seems to be pretty unhappy with the state of academic culture, I would presume, by the tone of this book.
I think a lot of the critique is coming from inside the house.
Inside
I think
house.
A lot of the frustration is just Catherine Liu dealing with her colleagues. I think a lot of this comes from an academic publishing a semi-academic book. It's University of Minnesota Press, but it's part of this series. It's called Forerunners, Ideas First. And all these books are under 100 pages or so. They're for academic books.
Different authors. Different.
Exactly.
Different academics. It's not a series by Catherine Liu, but by different.
Yeah,
people.
Yeah. Got it. Sorry. I should have made that clear. And they're all on kind of hot topics, things that people outside of academia might actually care about, and written in a style that's typically polemical and a case against something. So, you know, that's kind of where the sort of semi-academic openly advocating or openly criticizing something that, you know, more than academics care about. So I thought it was pretty readable, and I thought
it's a quick read. I mean, it's almost like a long article.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's not that much longer than, you know, a long Atlantic article or something. And it's got a pretty simple argument. I take Liu to be saying the PMC is what is standing in the way of any kind of progressive change. And she defines that as kind of any change that would help affirm the dignity of ordinary people and especially the working class. And this is cashed out as the claim that the PMC is deeply hostile to the redistributive politics of somebody like Bernie Sanders, the kind of policies that President Sanders, had he won, would have implemented. Instead, the PMC gets caught up in, you know, virtue games, virtue signaling, pretending that it's some kind of vanguard, pretending it's some kind of revolutionary class, but it's actually just hopelessly reactionary, and that it's actually more closely aligned with the interests of, as Leo puts it, corporate overlords than the struggle of ordinary Americans. Am I basically stating your understanding of the argument as well? Because I know we had somewhat different reactions to this book here.
I'm just
trying to give it like she states it in the intro. She states it.
Yeah, I think that's basically it. I mean, this is not a novel argument, right? Like this is part of a growing refrain that we've seen. She cites like Andrea Nagel, and that book went pretty viral, and she cites quite a few other works. And I think it's in the air, right? Like I think it's in the air. Just as well. There's a vibe here about the sort of absurdity of the culture of this class. Yeah. But, you know, like with all these works, like to begin with, and I think fundamentally it's fine. Like I think I agree with a lot of her analysis, and she's clearly like very smart and makes some of the polemicism here I think is a little bit over the top and you know, mocking these people for playing Mozart, you know, against their pregnant bellies, or going for, I don't know, some latest, you know, fasting regime, you know, something like that. Like,
yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's easy to make fun of these people. It's, you know, whatever. I just took that to be like a tonal thing, but
that's low hanging fruit too.
I agree. I wasn't a huge fan of that just because it's like, it's so easy to get away from that. Right. Mm-hmm. To say, yeah, I don't do that. You know, I don't know anyone that does that. But how does she define, like, one of the things that I find missing in all this is, like, what is the PMC? Like, how is it defined by her? Mm-hmm. You know, like, is there an income cutoff, a wealth cutoff? Yeah. Is there a certain job sector that they have to be in? Like, she does throw out a few things, right? But I don't think there's any clear definition of who these people actually are.
No clear definition. She cites Barbara Ehrenreich. And Barbara Ehrenreich does have a sort of job-based or labor-based definition of the PMC. And the basic idea there is if you're not, strictly speaking, working class or capitalist class, there's, you know, the residual almost. It's like you're the middle class. And then within the middle class, there's a certain sector of work that mainly has to do with having technical skills, managerial skills, educational skills, and in some cases, cultural skills. So I take that to be a quasi-Marxist. Actually, I think Ehrenreich is self-identified Marxist, and I believe Leo identifies as a socialist. I don't know if she says Marxist, but you know, it's a labor-based definition. And I know you were pushing back on that in some of our pre-conversation because you prefer a wealth-based definition. Am I portraying your position correctly? Because that I think is a very interesting redefinition of the problem, because you're talking about class not as in the work you do, but class rather in the sense of the assets you own, or rather class status. Does that make sense?
Well, I think the book is pretty, to be honest, I think it's like, it is exactly what I expected it to be. And so I don't think we need to recap the book. It's basically a digest of all of the sort of like cultural and just sort of like the cultural and political disgust that a lot of people feel towards the this PMC, howsoever defined. I don't think that's an uncommon feeling these days, right?
Yeah.
So no need for us to like describe or summarize the book because it is what it is. We could just, I mean, I think as an example of the genre of this type of like anti-PMC polemicism that's going on out there.
Yeah.
You're right. I think like we need to figure out like who exactly we're talking about. And it's not okay. So for me, it's not a question of who's in and who's out of the PMC. Like, I don't really care about that. I'm just saying like, okay, let's say we have all different ways of defining it. Some are using an income test. Some are using an education test. Some are using a job function test, you know, whatever it is. Right. Okay. I would say, roughly speaking, we're all converging on sort of the same set of people. And maybe we call it like the top nine, the next, some call it the next 9%, the talented 10th, whatever it is. Right. Mm-hmm. Something in that 90th area, you know, the A, the people who have an A, you know, in terms of socioeconomic status. Okay.
I hear you. I hear you. You're saying that next 9%, however, whatever we're taking a percentage of.
Yeah, I think we have like more or less like maybe we might disagree on the edges, but like fundamentally speaking, I think we've located, you know, who these people are. It's not quite a mystery, is it? So I don't think definitional rigor is the issue. I think the issue is this assumption that and I think that she doesn't quite land this issue because in the conclusion she doesn't really spot this as a feature of this group, is that if you, and I sent you like you know, a really rudimentary chart of wealth distribution in the United States, and as you hit the 80th percentile, it, you can see it basically start lifting off from what is essentially zero. Null, right? It starts to lift off at around the 80th percentile. By the 90th percentile, it's more than doubled. And then it doubles again, I think, by the 92nd. And then it doubles again by like the 93rd. And then the 93rd and a half. Like, it begins to grow exponentially as you enter the sort of 90th percentile. And if we're whatever, I guess the reason I don't care about definitional rigor is like, if it's roughly in that area, then I think the one of the core features of life of the PMC, and you are a member of the PMC, I'm a member of the PMC, I think by anyone's definition, we're probably in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Is that, I don't know if you'd agree with me on this, but I think that the core, one of the core features of this group is an intense amount of inequality, but because we're low, like because we're looking solely within this subgroup of the 90th percentile on up, let's say, we don't really care in a political sense about that inequality, and I'm not saying I care about it. But I would say that is an essential feature of the PMC, is that there is a wild, they exist on the wealth, the end of the wealth spectrum, where there is just a wild amount of inequality. And I think that's borne out in regular daily experience, where people in the PMC really have no idea how much their peers make or have. To understand what your peers make is one thing, that's already sort of hidden, but to know what they have is even more hidden. And I think that itself is an incredibly important feature that often is left unsaid, because we just talk about PMC and a sort of like general liberal collapse of that group into quote privileged. And once you're privileged, nothing further needs to be said about it. Yep.
So my initial thought is, can we talk about upper PMC and lower PMC in the same way that we can talk about upper middle class and lower middle class, because, you know, sorry to be a little bit pedantic, but if you accept that the PMC is actually just a subset of this broader thing we call middle class, that's one way of trying to work through that issue. So I'm not a numbers person, so I'm just going to sort of translate the chart you showed me into the simplest terms, which is maybe the PMC, if we do count it as a class, has the highest degree of inequality. Like that was one of the ways you actually explained
relative
this
inequality,
idea to me, right?
Yeah.
The highest degree of relative inequality, but we don't actually make much out of this. In fact, it's really interesting, not only insofar as PMCs might not know, you know, if their PMC down the hall has a trust fund or owns, you know, stocks or has other investments.
Yeah, or is getting
paid. They might
paid
not even know what they're.
Well, is sorry, getting paid much more than you for doing the same job because they,
exactly.
they somehow negotiated a better deal and you're not allowed to talk about that.
Exactly. The salary too. And, you know, just compensation and what kind of deal they're getting from the management. I think those are, it's very interesting because resentment of the PMC and resentment towards the PMC, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is not usually about how much wealth they have or their earnings. It's usually posed in moral and cultural terms. In other words, what makes the PMC feel snooty or better than, you know, what is sometimes sneeringly referred to as Trump's base, or towards somebody who's understood to not have the right attitudes towards ethnic, racial, sexual, gender minorities. You know, that's not actually what how the PMC conceives itself. You know, it conceives itself in kind of moral cultural terms, and typically in terms of superiority over this imagined, who knows if it has anything to do with reality, but this imagined working class figure. And that's where like the better educated or, you know, lack of education is to explain populism, for example. That's a very PMC idea, right? Similarly, when resentment is expressed towards the PMC, it's usually not about their wealth, their income, or their class status. It's usually that they act snooty and look down upon people and are always insecure to prove that they're up on what's on NPR and play Mozart to the baby, the other one you mentioned, and the like. So I actually think this is an interesting lack of economic analysis around wealth and income. I don't know what else to make of that or where that goes. I'm in a bit of a strange industry because I'm a state of Connecticut public employee. So I teach at the University of Connecticut, and I can just open up a website and look at everyone's salaries. So I can't look at the wealth, but I can see what kind of deal
right,
I got.
Right, right. Yep.
And
yep.
That is an unending source of whispering, gossip, and resentment.
Yeah, you know, I used to work for the federal government, and it was the same thing. Everyone's salary is public record, and I remember getting, you know, at a cocktail party, at a sort of like work event. These two younger people on the team, somewhat younger. Just sort of like spending a lot of time bashing an older employee for making significantly more than they do, just according to like a public pay scale.
Yeah.
I have sensed a lot of resentment over, you know, rather small differences in income. And, I think that, I identified that as part of the sort of like pathology of PMC.
Right.
Yeah.
And you can't talk openly about it. That's the other
You can't talk openly about it, but unless you're hidden in a corner at a work event and you're, you know, you've established rapport with, you know, someone as an ally, and then you can start saying things, and
you've got a little trust, you got a little alcohol.
Yeah. And then the claws come out.
People start talking. Yeah. The claws come out.
Yeah.
No, I think it says something about the ways that the PMC or we, you know, I keep trying to distance myself from this. The way that we in the PMC at some level, we actually realize that we are professionals, that at the end of the day, much of the conformity to the more stultifying aspects of PMC culture are actually just about not losing professional opportunities. We know that our status in society turns on our professional status, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? At some level, we know that. But what we're actually comfortable talking about and comfortable, more comfortable thinking about is education and cultural habits, having liberal and tolerant attitudes, believing in meritocracy and technocracy, and et cetera. So I think there's a little bit of a, I don't know what you want to call it, a bad faith understanding, this class's understanding of ourselves, the PMC's understanding, self-conception. At some level, we actually know what it is. At another level, we tell ourselves some stories. In other words, in reality, this is about economics. But we like to talk about it as if it were morality and about virtue and not being a degenerate, et cetera.
I'm not so convinced, I'm not so convinced that the PMC is marked by a sort of moral narcissism the way she puts it out as. I mean, maybe that is true, I think, at the sources of the culture where we're talking about, like, the cultural elite. But I wouldn't necessarily call the cultural elite the PMC, right? So so people...
Cultural elite as in... Sorry, just clarifying question.
Media figures of public renown.
Like a journalist or...
Yeah, writers, celebrities...
Right.
You know, celebrity journalists, you know, things like that, right? So
Rachel Maddow.
Yeah. Like that's not PMC, right? Like, these people are, like, wealthy celebrities. That's not, they're not part of the PMC. They appear as part of the PMC, I think. They look like part of the PMC, but I think that that's a sort of front. And they're actually, like, in some ways the purveyors of or popularizers of PMC edicts,
right?
Cultural edicts. I think that the culture is not an organic culture that's coming out of the PMC themselves. It's a mandatory cultural code that's enforced through the ministries of culture, which, in my opinion, in our private system of private enterprises, the collective of all the different HR departments. And
so HR, the media, university,
HR being a disciplinarian function. I mean, it's basically a you know, workforce disciplinarian and surveillance function,
right. No, I don't disagree with that. I don't disagree with that at all. Well, first thought is, coming back to the inequality theme, the average journalist is actually, I don't know on the wealth scale, the average journalist, though, I cannot believe, especially in this age where, you know, national papers are shutting down, you know, we don't have to bring up the local papers, you know, I don't think they're making that much.
No, it's a handful of individuals. You said, it's a Rachel Maddow. Yes. They're celebrities. I'm talking about the celebrities.
The celebrities. Yes.
I'm talking about the celebrities.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So we're just sorry. This is just another way back into the inequality theme.
Sure. Yeah.
And the huge inequality between a media celebrity who happens to be a celebrity by virtue of their journalistic position and an average journalist who I would bet has to do a couple jobs on the side, maybe in the gig economy, just to make ends meet if they're not independently wealthy.
Oh, for sure.
I think, you know, similar forms of steep inequality are very prevalent. For example, in my industry, academia, we have a few small amount of celebrity intellectuals. We used to have more, you know, but, you know, back in the era, in the heyday of these celebrity academics, we had people like Judith Butler and, you know, Cornel West. And I'm sure there are more that are escaping me right now. But the trend over the last 50 years is most academic labor is just year to year. And in some cases, semester to semester, the so-called adjunct class. And the gap, again, is huge. Not probably as huge as between an NBC, you know, national anchor and your local paper's, you know, beat reporter, but it's huge. I also happen to think that much of the worst and probably most pathological PMC cultural psychology comes from the top, as you were saying. It comes from the top, and it's really about disciplining the workplace, but it's posed in a very, you know, DEI is a perfect example of this. The problem with DEI is not that racial oppression is good. It's that what DEI is actually about doing is making shiny brochures to say we've got a few Asians usually, or African-Americans or Latinas at the top. And that's what the actual, you know, progressive, supposed progressive culture, et cetera, is actually about.
Oh, I think DEI is a little bit more sinister than that.
Okay. It could be even worse, but if you see what I'm saying, it's not an organic culture.
No.
And a lot of so for me, the problem isn't that the PMC tries to be progressive. It's that the professional aspects hollowed out and very cynically used what are actually legitimate issues. Does
yeah,
that make sense?
I think that she actually starts to touch on this in the book, right? Where she says that the... though it's not like I feel like this should have been the main. If I were to write such a book, this would be my main theme. Whereas I think she's mentions it, which is that though it's a very astute observation, which is that the PMC are obligated, as you say, to be enthusiastic participants and reproducers of this culture. Mm-hmm. Right. So not only are you supposed to know it, you're supposed to reproduce it and act it out in your interactions with other people. You abide by the norms of this culture. And she says the problem with that right now is that it's starting to what that culture attempts to do is to build a certain kind of class solidarity through a shared culture. But it's getting harder for people to do it because of the inherent anti-solidarity aspects of that culture, which is the material precarity, which translates in her view as the hyper-competitiveness of this class.
Yeah.
So how can you have a shared culture when the very social condition of that culture is hyper-competition and a lack of trust? Mm-hmm. I think that that's getting close. I think that's getting close to it. But I think also she doesn't, because to do this would grant a sort of like grievance status to the PMC, which is something that she doesn't want to do because she's, I think, in a way, valorizing the PMC in a certain way. She's valorizing them as being the key to revolution. Meaning, like, if they would only change their mind, everything would get better. It's literally all their fault, right? And so to grant that the PMC actually live under conditions of extreme inequality themselves, albeit within, nestled within the top 10% of the country, let's say, is sort of a little bit too precious, a little bit too self-indulgent to countenance. And so that would take us away from the polemicist spirit of her work, which is a self-directed polemic, which is therefore an act of self-loathing. The whole book, in my opinion, is an act of self-loathing, and also a kind of super snobbery. I think it's her looking at the liberal snobbery that she sees abounding in her world and taking the initiative to say, and I don't dislike her about this. I do not necessarily dislike this. I'm just pointing it out that she has this attitude. And I see this quite commonly within this world where truly nobody likes each other anyway. I mean, not in a real way. You think that you're a snob? I'm such a snob. I'm such an elite liberal that maybe I will use this culture of liberal snobbery against you right now. And I think that's what she's doing. She's trying to say, you know what? I have enough status in this world by the standards of the PMC culture to exercise a little bit of PMC power and turn our weaponized culture against ourselves, but mostly the rest of you, because I've come to understand why some of you suffer from brain rot, and I'm going to try and fix you. You know, I think that is what she's doing. And again, I'm just pointing it out. I don't necessarily dislike that about her. I kind of enjoy the spirit of it, but I do think that's what she's doing.
You know. So a couple things. She does not want to make the PMC out to be any kind of victims.
Yes, correct.
You know, it's more of a, you did this to yourself. Mm. And insofar as, you know, the way she describes it, she addresses the reader. She says, if you, like me, are an ambivalent PMC, this book is for you.
Yes, she does say that. Yeah.
So I think she's pretty aware of the rhetorical strategy, because another way of posing your point about self-loathing is she's saying we pretend to be all superior, but actually there's a lot of things we should be ashamed of. And so she's trying to tap into that sense of shame and saying, we can do better than this. Okay. And you could call it a kind of turning snobbery on the snobs.
Do you think, well, let me stop you there for a sec. Do you think she would accept what you just said, that fundamentally she's trying to get the PMC to, quote, do better or be better?
Yes.
That this is a call to arms for the PMC to reform itself, right? You think she would agree with that? The way I read it,
the point of, and I believe it's a little hyperbolic, she says the true enemy is not the populist right. And again, we can come back to this because I know you kind of suspect she thinks the true enemy is the populist right. Mm-hmm. But she says the true enemy is not the populist right. The real roadblock to Bernie Sanders' political revolution is the PMC. And the reason she's saying that is What's her audience? It's the PMC. Mm-hmm. And you don't actually move anyone to action. And this is like kind of just kind of the manifesto-y side of this. The manifesto is about encouraging a particular sector or a particular group of people to get up and actually do something. And so what she says is, I know you think you're insignificant and you're not actually important, and maybe that's part of your hidden fear, and maybe that's why, you know, as a compensation, you like to talk about how you're morally superior to the less educated. And some of us in the academic PMC think we're morally superior to the capitalist class. There's a lot of that kind of like, well, we pursue truth, they pursue profit, you know, that kind of stuff. Okay, so you're kidding yourself about what you're really doing. You should be ashamed of this. And because you actually do matter, because you are actually responsible for not talking about class politics anymore and rather talking about the politics of cultural transgression, or because you are not openly advocating for socialist redistribution measures, but you are trying to, you know, use books like To Kill a Mockingbird to help liberal, middle-class PMC teenagers empathize more with poor whites, but actually you talk down to them and you say they're bad because they accept public support and, you know, food stamps and so forth. You know, I was just looking at the PMC Reads a Book chapter again. Okay. So I think some of the seeming inflated importance.
Or they get divorced a lot and have children out of wedlock, but yeah.
Exactly. There's some kind of cultural problem, right? There's no, the problem is not that there's no jobs and they've got no real career opportunities. The problem is fathers aren't taking responsibility or, you know, cling to guns or whatever Obama kind of phrases you want to recycle
there.
The white
working class of the quote working class. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Blame the white working class. Okay. So that's a very PMC kind of thing. Sorry. So if coming back to this, why does she seem to inflate the importance of the PMC? I think it's because the rhetorical appeal is to the PMC itself. And if you say you're just useless and you don't matter, there's no point in doing anything.
You're saying that she's trying to light a fire under their ass.
That's right.
Rather than to truly break them down.
So it's like the tough love. It's like talking tough to those who have the ears for it, or those who can actually stomach a little bit of a little bit more honesty. So
isn't that in service of the idea that they would embrace a sort of like left economic populism and become sort of the vanguard of a proper political revolution, aka Bernie could have won if only you guys, you know, didn't get on board with you know, the it's her time kind of thing, right?
I think that's the strongest way of turning the Leo argument that the PMC fancies itself vanguards against Leo herself, that she has a little bit of that idea.
Is she a political moderate, do you think? Like, she just wants a Bernie Sanders type thing?
I mean, if you want to call that a moderate, I would say
it used to be quite a moderate. I mean, Bernie Sanders, in the context of American politics beyond just the past 15, 20 years, is a moderate.
I think she, and again, I've only read this. I haven't listened to the pods. I haven't read the occasional pieces. I think she's using some hard left language, and the class warfare one is the most obvious example.
It always comes across as a little surprising when she launches into class warfare.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, it seems a little bit
about that.
Yeah, it seems a little
bit. She's not talking about class warfare.
Affected the way she uses it. But yeah, go on. I feel like she's very moderate, to be honest.
I think she's the center left. Green New Deal. There's passages and conclusion that point in that direction and that say, you know, we need expertise.
Incremental. We need wealth redistribution.
That's right. Yeah. We need high taxes to fund free college education. I mean, that's how I read all that.
We need a European style sort of social safety net.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's social democracy. And if you want to, you know, I think that the Democratic Party's progressive wing does have a strong let's make the New Deal great again.
Yeah.
You know, that is their idea that 1930s through the 1960s is the good old days.
Yeah.
And the PMC arguably did play a progressive role. I was looking at the Barbara and John Ehrenreich's, it's an article in a journal called Radical America from, I think it's the 1970s. In any case, they point out that all those student radicals who either came from the PMC or who were from the working class and en route to becoming the PMC because they were going to college, you know, and many were first in their families to go to college and all that, they were on their way. When they graduated and actually had to find jobs, many of them entered the PMC. And they tried to do some, the strategy was called radicalized professions. And the Ehrenreichs believed that there was something to this. I mean, and this is why I bring this up. I bet you Leo has the idea in the back of her head that middle-class reformers were once actually able to do, you know, more radical kinds of reform. I don't think she's a revolutionary. I think she uses the language of political revolution to basically say we need to reinvigorate social democracy.
As it used to be.
As it used to be. And
you're talking about like sort of like high liberalism of the 60s that she refers to? Or
Yeah. So, in the Ehrenreich piece, they say, okay, back in the 60s and 70s, there were radical teachers who would, to the students, try and undermine their authority and say, I don't know everything. And you know what? This whole education system is about making widgets for the capitalist machine.
How is this not just left MAGA?
Well, it's left populism.
Yeah.
It's left populism.
It's reactionary, isn't it? I mean, isn't it reactionary?
It's anti-elite. And it tries to give ordinary people credit for knowing stuff and having potential. And
Do you really see that as anti-elite, as bona fide anti-elite? Or is this actually – because I see this as sort of reactionary to say in the sense of it's sort of like a regressive politics to say that the main difference with MAGA is that MAGA seems to idealize a certain fantasy aspect of the 1950s, maybe.
Yeah, different period.
Yeah, and maybe the liberals are either going to the 60s or maybe to the pre-war period to some extent.
Yeah.
But both are fundamentally reactionary. It's just a question of which decade do you choose?
I think they are both reactionary in the sense of not revolutionary. I think they're both reactionary in the past orientation, I think, but I'm one of these people that thinks left versus right is a real thing. I know some
people reject
that.
You don't think you can have a reactionary revolution? Or
I think that is more like counter-revolution or restoration. So this is very much a poli-sci perspective, but for me, there are really only two things that we should call revolutionary. And they're both about creating something new. So obviously, prior to French, Haitian, and U.S. revolutions, revolution had a different name. It actually meant circling back. That's why revolve is the root of it. But once the 18th century revolutions happened, and the idea is revolution is actually about bringing about the new, I would say the United States has actually only had two of those. And the first is a new political system, also known as American Revolution, also known as the Constitutional Founding. Like, that's the new, you know, you got to cross a certain threshold for me before you can call it revolutionary or new. And so founding a new constitution is a clear case of that. I reject, so that's political revolution for me.
Okay, yep, I agree.
Sanders, creating the New Deal in the first time around, that wasn't a political revolution. That was a reform. That was a new policy paradigm and a new cultural paradigm. And we could say similar things about Andrew Jackson's expansion of the franchise and changes in American Indian policy.
What about Civil War and Reconstruction?
Well, that's exactly the other one. Mm. That's exactly the other one. Because for me, the other kind of revolution is social revolution. And social revolution, at least the way that the left has used it, means changing in the economy. And the change from a slave economy or an economy which, you know, half the country was using based on just brutal course of race-based labor extraction to the aftermath, although, of course, we know, you know, slavery has long afterlife and there was sharecropping and slavery by another name, you know, with chain gangs and all that. I think that is at least as big as a change in economic terms as moving from British Empire to United States Constitution. So I guess what I'm saying is I kind of have a pretty high bar for saying something is revolutionary. I think there are plenty of changes that can happen within a paradigm set by a revolution. So for me, civil rights movement, and I'm now taking back some of my own writing, is less revolutionary than what happened in the Civil War and Reconstruction. Does that make sense? Because
it does,
you move from a slave system to so-called free labor, that is a bigger change than moving from legal segregation to de facto segregation.
But you're talking about this from a sort of objective, almost academic taxonomy, right?
Yes.
Whereas here, with the way that someone like Liu writes about revolution, there is a sort of like normative aspect to it, which is to say we want revolution.
Right.
Right. Bernie Sanders said he wanted a political revolution, ergo he is a revolutionary or had revolutionary potential. Whether that fits the taxonomy of actual revolution, I don't know. But what I'm saying is that to her, whatever revolution means, right? And I think this is important. I think what she's saying is whatever revolution is, we want that. We need it. Maybe it doesn't fit your taxonomy of revolution or your definition of revolution. But my point is that when she uses the term revolution, it's generally as something we want, especially a bona fide socialist revolution, which I think towards the end of the book, in fact, I think almost on the last page, she comes out and sort of has this, you know, just straight up statement that the PMC is standing in the way of a socialist revolution, right? So now I'm not like, regardless of whether, you know, a return to a return to the trajectory towards social democracy that we had, say, at high liberalism, is a revolution or not. I don't really have a view on that, and I don't think you need one in this case. I think the fundamental thing that means she is not escaping, in my opinion. People who engage in these polemics, she's not the only one, but this is very emblematic of them, are not actually transgressing anything. And that is, in fact, one of her core critiques of liberal culture, is that it is sort of like has the form of transgression, but it's never truly transgressive. And I think these polemics are exactly the same, because no matter how angry she gets, no matter how condescending she gets, no matter how pissed off she gets, fundamentally speaking, what she's saying is, you are too good for this. You are needed in other ways. And if you don't do it, it will never be done. And in fact, we already see the outcome of you not doing it is you get these false, these political antichrists like Trump, false prophets who appear and do and steal it from you. And that's, and to me, I think that's why I think that she thinks right populism is an inherent threat. Whereas, for example, neoliberalism as an economic system, a political economy, is not an inherent threat. It's a failure, right? So if you look at the purported aims of neoliberalism, the purported values of neoliberalism, we could stand behind it. It is not inherently bad. But if you look at the record of neoliberalism over the past 20 years, it's obviously a failure, and no, you know, it's a political failure as well. Okay, there's a realism to that. However, when talking about right populism, we don't even need to look at the record. We just know that Trump is bad. Trump is a threat. It doesn't matter what his record is. He's just bad.
Just checking in here. So by neoliberalism, you mean the free trading, make everything a market, government austerity.
Yes.
Okay, that general program. Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. So you separate that from Trump's economic policy, because Trump would get in a trade war. Trump gets you out of NAFTA. Trump takes you out of international climate accords, etc.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Gotcha.
Correct.
So Trump's economic
nationalism. That's just bad.
Nationalism. I mean, that's what you're talking about, right? Trump's economic nationalism, also known as America First. You're saying that Leo dismisses it even more than she dismisses neoliberalism, which she believes is the PMC's kind of intuitive economic philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
She actually criticizes neoliberalism. She just dismisses Trumpism. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, she looks at neoliberalism as a failure. And think about it. If it's a failure, it can only be a failure if it had promise.
I think she thinks neoliberalism is basically capitalism on steroids. And her general claim is that the PMC, and I'm agreed with you, refuses to even say capitalism. I'm agreed with you that that's not true.
Yeah.
The PMC is since 2008 has had a resurgence of anti-capitalists, often with a lot of vibes and not a lot of theory. Mm-hmm. Anti-capitalist screeds.
And sometimes with theory. I mean, she calls out 1619 Project as one of the worst examples of PMC culture run amok. But 1619 Project was constantly associating slavery as a form of capitalism or a precursor to capitalism. And and not just slavery, but Jim Crow and the continued anti-black discrimination. I mean, it's always been tied to capitalism. I just felt like and that wasn't a throwaway sentence. I mean, like when she said that that one of the hallmarks of the PMC is that they will find fault with this or that, but they won't name the true enemy, which is capitalism. Like, they name it all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important point, I think, is that one of her core calls to action, and this is my issue with these polemics, these liberal self-directed polemics, is they and a lot of people have pointed this out, they never tell you what to do. What is the actual step? What is the step? that we as people need to take, right? So, and it's never answered. And if you were to level, I think if you were to level a critique at her, that specific critique, she would say, "I said exactly what it is." And then it would be something like, "They need to the PMC need to wake up and see that capitalism is the true enemy." I'm like, they've already done that, and it doesn't matter. Like, you know, it's not, that's not a step. It's a vibe. And, you know, it's funny because, sorry, I'm ranting a little bit here, but I just want to get this out and get your reaction to it is, you know, she begins her conclusion as saying that Marxism and as a theoretical route for socialism is all about material reality. It's rooted in materialism. It's rooted in material conditions. It's rooted in the real economy. Whereas liberal culture is rooted in vibes and cultural relativism, identity politics, you know, things we can't touch, things we can't consume, things we can't make. Okay. But then if you look at her program, her recommended program for PMC reform, it's name capitalism. You know, reform reform your ideas. Think different.
Yeah.
And it's like, isn't that exactly the problem that you've been accusing them of? That it's always vibes and never real action? So I think the thing that I'm always wondering is what exactly, I'm not talking in like name capitalism or wake up to the true enemy or discover what the nature of your bond, you know, okay, but what exactly can I do, you know, as a member of the PMC that would exonerate me from this polemic? And I'm not sure that there is anything in there that would be a clear instruction.
I think that's right. I think the manifesto dimension or the manifesto-y sections of this pamphlet really are limited in that they're a call to action without a program. And there are a number of possibilities as to why that might be the case. You know, if you deal with the standard socialist manifesto, and this is, you know, obviously the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels, but also more recent manifestos like Kohei Saito's Slow Down. It's a degrowth manifesto. Just an example, Aaron Bastani's fully automated luxury communism, another one. There's always a specific program.
Would you add our boy Byung-Chul Han to that? You think he counts?
I don't think he's Marxist enough.
Okay.
To fall into the genre of Communist Manifesto, but I am not an expert on Han, so But I guess the manifesto.
Sorry, I just want to understand. You're talking about things in the vein of socialist revolution.
That's right.
Okay. All right. I understand.
And that have the defining features of manifesto, which is a set of demands, a agent, the agent of revolution or whatever, the political actor, and a path for the actor to take to achieve the demands. And that whole framework was laid out, you know, for the Marxist tradition by the Communist Manifesto. And it's continued to like contemporary, like within the last year or so publications. And I guess, I think this is fair criticism. If we accept that Leo actually thinks that there's a practical activity to be demanded, it's not like, okay, like in the manifesto, it's like abolition of inheritance, free public education, et cetera. Bernie Sanders' political revolution actually comes way closer. He's saying the actor is the American citizenry and the electorate, we've got this program, $15 minimum wage, et cetera, Green New Deal, et cetera. And the path forward is just voting. Okay. And Catherine Liu, yeah, I do think this is a fair critique. She basically says, you need to start doing more anti-capitalist critique and make it the centerpiece of your intellectual activity. That's basically what she's saying. And this whole thing, you know, about vibes and immaterial forms of critique, she's really talking to the critical theorists, and this is where the Irvine thing actually matters, I think, because there's a whole bunch of non-Marxist critical theorists at UC Irvine who basically, instead of, you know, Marx and Engels, want to build their critical theory out of people like Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. And that's who she makes fun of a lot. Sorry, these are the so-called post-structuralists.
The post-structuralists.
And that's what she's saying. So she's not saying don't have ideas. And she's not saying that intellectual labor is not labor. That's how the Marxist types conceive of this. It's sometimes called immaterial labor. It's sometimes called symbolic labor, you know, manipulating words and so forth. But they consider it work. And she's saying your work needs a new center. Instead of moralizing, you need to do materialist critique. Instead of Foucault, you need to come back to Marx. Thank you for reminding me. She is explicitly a Marxist. She says Marx, right?
Yeah, I believe okay. So, yeah.
So this is how I...
No, I
makes sorry, sense.
I don't know if that makes her a Marxist. I couldn't tell if she was saying the Marxist ideal is this,
yeah,
and PMC culture falls short of it, or whether she was just drawing a distinction between the two. But
yeah,
I no, got that... the feeling that she's at least Marxist sympathetic, right? She's sympathetic to Marxism for sure.
Yeah, I think that's right. So, and I think that's actually how to read her problem with Hannah Jones, the lead scholar historian behind the 1619 Project. It's not that the 1619 Project denies that slavery was about making money. It's that they don't have the Marxist understanding of how slavery was about making money, which is a theory of hyper-exploitation and trying to connect the paying slaves zero to the paying proletarians or nominally free labor the lowest possible wages. Does that make sense? It's just a different way of looking at the race and capitalism relationship.
Sorry,
go ahead.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's what she's really mad at. She's mad that Nicole Hannah Jones is not Marxist enough and just has a broader critique saying, you know what? Of course, race was motivated more by, sorry, I haven't actually read 1619 Project, so I'm bluffing. But from what I understand, she's saying it was motivated more by like, capitalism in a broad sense and anti-blackness in a specific sense. It doesn't have the right theory of labor that could actually explain why all labor is unfree.
I think she was leveling a much harsher critique of 1619. Hmm. I think she was saying that 1619 was a psyop. And that the whole point of 1619 is to assert racial division as the sort of like structural foundation of American inequality over capitalism and class inequality. And that was a intentional but unstated, that was the intent of 1619, even though unstated, though she said actually it was stated until they realized that might be a little bit too on the nose and decided to revise it. But that some of the sort of like Marxist watchdogs out there, socialist watchdog organizations had saved the original websites and website language, and therefore they can't really disavow that they're fundamentally a PSYOP, which is sort of a, you know, like a blue state progressive version of the Southern strategy, which is to say, how do we prevent the white working class and the black underclass from getting together and overthrowing us? Well, let's employ white supremacy, you know, that and make sure that these two sides hate each other. She's essentially accusing 1619 of doing that. So, I'm not saying she's wrong, but I think that this was a pretty, I thought that she was maybe not wrong, actually. I thought that this might have been a pretty astute critique, is I think she was going all in to say 1619 is not just academically wrongheaded, it's academically fraudulent, yes, but more than that, it's a PSYOP.
So, you know, to be clear, 1619 is superficially anti-capitalist. Instead of privileging economic base, it puts racism in the most fundamental position. And so, though it may draw some kind of links, especially in the earlier versions of the website, between race and capitalism, or sorry, slavery and capitalism, what ends up happening is it's a race first, it's all about anti-blackness. And what this means is the original sin of the United States is anti-blackness. Whites, including working class whites, are anti-black at their core, and they would never be able, you know, to do the what the socialists of the civil rights movement wanted. Actually, even economic populists like C. Van Woodward were advocating for, which is white worker, black worker, unite and fight.
Yeah, and you could see it in operation. I mean, I think that there was a lot of intimation during Bernie's campaign especially the first primary, that he was courting a certain kind of like right-wing white guy.
Yeah.
And that his campaign was not forcefully denouncing these people. And I think that that's part of the strategy, right? Is to accuse a Bernie Sanders of being sort of like crypto white nationalist, or at least tolerant of that element in his party, in order to ensure that he's repellent to black voters. And then they had these, like, you remember there's that famous video of like two black, young black female activists sort of like getting all up in his face and forcing him off stage, and he couldn't do anything because he was like, I can't attack these people, I can't fight back,
right?
That, you know, and that shows you the potency of this. Of, I think that video shows the potency of 1619, and I think she was pretty accurate in her condemnation of that project as essentially a political PSYOP. I think she's right about that.
I think, Sanders was a bit unfairly being accused of trying to win back rural white guys to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I think Sanders,
just white guys. I mean, even suburban white guys, but mostly like younger white men. I think that's
yes. Now, he clearly made some moves and did some outreach towards that demographic. You don't go on Joe Rogan if you're trying to get the Latina PMC. You know, that Joe Rogan is about guys and, yes, multiracial, but the core of it is white guys. I think that direction.
I think the Dem establishment, you know, is basically saying, if you go after the white working class, you cannot have the POC voters. We're not going to let you have them.
This is the unfortunate bifurcation of race and class. The understanding here is Democratic establishment was basically saying, we're a multi-ethnic, multiracial coalition, and we are going to prove it by, you know, Obama and Harris and, you know, updated kind of Rainbow Coalition, but less populist and more among the elite, right? And, you know, that read of Obama as kind of the PMC dream candidate, I think that's right. I mean, that's totally right. Although some people farther to the left, center left, also went for Obama. And so you have a race only analysis, and so you get a Sanders type who has a mostly class analysis. I mean, I think he was forced to adjust here, especially after he was confronted about the lack of programs specifically for African Americans. You know, he had a more, you know, I'm for the working class, which was consistent with his democratic socialism, which was also just kind of consistent with his understanding of how politics work. You know, he's a class first person. So when the Democratic establishment, which doesn't want to talk about class, but which is comfortable about talking racial diversity among the elite, hears that class first message, the quickest and dirtiest way to attack that vulnerability is to say that he is a hidden pro-whiteness. He's hidden, you know, he's really, you know, just dog whistling for the Trump rural white,
yeah.
The Trump white voter. Because yeah. I think you're right. It wasn't even as subtle at that time, you won't believe it.
Remember, you won't believe this, but they had Harvey Weinstein go on MSNBC and accuse Bernie Sanders of sexism.
Yeah, that's too much. Yeah, exactly. No, that's the other one. Yeah, that's the other one. You know, when he did his class first thing, the other place
Elizabeth
he was
Warren
vulnerable
was
is exactly
Elizabeth
where
Warren,
he's vulnerable.
Remember when Elizabeth Warren suddenly accused him of claiming that she should drop out because she's a woman?
Yeah, no, it's like that kind it's of very weaponized.
Yeah.
It was very weaponized, and it was all this intra-elite kind of battle. I mean, Sanders being a senator, I kind of count him, you know, the same as Warren there.
Let's summarize this for a sec, though, because I think we're talking about we're getting into the sort of like fine details here of the treatment of identity, right? But fundamentally, I agree. Here's my point. I agree with Liu's critique of this as being sort of like a blocker, like a sort of weaponized obstacle or containment field around individual identity groups so that they don't trust each other and they cannot form class solidarity with each other.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Yeah. I think the problem with that is if this is directed at the PMC, the book, she's advocating for the PMC to develop a true class consciousness of itself.
That's right.
And then realize that it's fundamentally a worker, it's a worker class.
I think this is where the autonomy and ability to choose bit comes in. And here I do agree there's a bit of a tension because you raised this point earlier. She makes fun of the PMC for believing that they are autonomous from their class position and that they are a moral and spiritual elite and therefore can transcend their class position and, you know, choose the politics they want. I do think there is at least an element of saying the PMC, if it woke up, would see that its interests are much closer to the working classes than it is to the billionaire class. I think, and I don't know how far to take this reading, because she's either saying objectively, just like in terms of wealth and power, we are closer to the working class and have more in common, you know, with a Starbucks worker than with a, you know, invest Warren Buffett, right? But at the same time, because of the manifesto quality to some of the writing, she has to present it as, well, we can actually choose. We can actually make a decision here. Because otherwise, why are you writing to the PMC? Why are you addressing them if we didn't really have choices? Or at least some autonomy.
What's the choice here? And by the way, let me propose
the choice
this.
Here is do we align ourselves with the working class or with the capitalist class?
I see.
And okay. that's the basic choice she's posing to us.
Yeah.
And sorry, so that's the other, sorry, and this is the more charitable way of reading what she's saying about naming capitalism as the enemy. What she's really saying is the capitalist class is the enemy. What she's really saying is the comrade, if you want to use the old school language, the comrade is the working class. And we need to recognize, as in, there's a prior objective reality, we're just much closer in wealth and power, or recognize in the sense of we need to decide to align ourselves in this way. I think it's a little bit ambivalent and a little bit ambiguous, but I think that's what she's saying. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, I was going to suggest that I don't know what your time is like, but we're at an hour 15, and I thought if we continue, we could do it as like the bonus portion where we actually talk, because here's the thing, is like I think there actually is a next step that people can take, that people should take, and I think a lot are actually taking now, and but it goes against, I think, a lot of the things that Leo prescribes, and I think that it's fundamentally back to this idea of the polemic form is not helpful. In fact, I think it just reproduces the problem.
Interesting.
But I don't know if you have any interest in doing that now, or
I'd be happy to do it now.
Yeah.
So we call this the regular episode and wrap it up here.
Yep. Yep. So Perfect if you want to hear the continuation of this discussion, go to the Patreon feed. And if you want to support, go to Patreon and get access to bonus pods and stuff, patreon.com/plantingmeg.
And just want to say thank you, Teen, for the re-invitation, and thank you all for listening. Yeah.